Good morning and welcome to the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. This morning, I'm again delighted to have as our guest Michael Dowd, Reverend Michael Dowd, author of Thank God for Evolution. Thank you for coming back, first of all.
Thank you, Frank. I'm delighted.
In reality, thank you for staying where you were when we recorded last week's show so that we could continue. The first time I've ever done this, I just had to keep going with you. The topic is religion. The topic is creation. The topic is evolution. The topic is science. All of those things finally being merged together. And you do these presentations. In fact, when you were here in Knoxville at the Unitarian Universalist Church, you say people many times come up to you after the presentation and say...
Yeah, the main comment that we get, we've done about 800 programs in the last 7 years of living in... I mean, because we permanently travel North America. We don't have a home. We don't even have a storage bin. I mean, we live permanently traveling.
All right, then what area code is your cell phone in?
Because my cell phone is Washington because that's where Connie's sister lives.
I recognize that number.
Our bank account is in Oregon. We vote in Michigan. My driver's license is in New York. I mean, we really don't have a home.
So the whole country is your neighborhood.
Well, actually, we feel like North America as a whole. We've named North America.
So when you
Nora.
Say when you say meet me at the Cracker Barrel, we have no idea which one you're talking about.
Yeah, we actually have the felt experience that the entire continent is our home. I mean, you go from your kitchen to your bathroom to your bedroom,
yeah,
and you keep feeling like you're home. Well, we go from one region to another, and we keep feeling like we're home because no one place is home. And humans have got to have a sense of home. We always will have some sense of home. So we've generalized the feeling of home to Nora, North America.
See,
we've named North America Nora.
See, I get that feeling because I've lived in three or four distinct different places in my life.
Yeah.
Because I've got family in yet other places, I feel like I know the neighborhoods. You know, when I visit California or Missouri or New York or Virginia or Tennessee, that all, in my mind, it's like it's all just one big area. Yeah. So I guess you take that and expand it out to 50 states.
Well, it took about a year and a half for me to realize why this lifestyle felt so totally like primordially satisfying, like deeper than our own personal history. And I remember when it did, it was like, here we are teaching and preaching a sacred understanding of evolution. And I didn't understand this before. For 97% or 98% of human existence, we didn't live in the same place year round. We'd migrate with the seasons and we'd come back to a place where we hadn't been for a year or two or three. And it was like a homecoming. And Connie and I have that experience all the time.
Okay, so we're talking then about the, I don't know if we're talking about the Neanderthal or
We're talking about most, I mean, no matter where people lived. When people lived in Europe
there's modern humans, we're talking homo sapiens.
Modern humans, you know, migrated with the seasons. Unless they lived right on the equator and there weren't seasons.
Yeah.
But if they lived in temperate zones where there were a change of seasons, they wouldn't stay and try to live through the winter. They would migrate south, and they would migrate back north with the spring and with
like the birds.
Exactly.
So who's the guy who thought it was a good idea to stay?
Well,
I know. I'll build an igloo.
Well,
that's a good idea.
Well, part of it is that when we domesticated fire, that allowed us to stay further north during the winters and things like that. But where I was going is that we've spoken in 700 or 800 different groups, and the most common comment that we get after our programs is somebody will say, you know, I've never heard it quite put together the way that you've done, yet I've always known it's true. It's
and
like this resonance with our nature.
And that is sums up also the reason why I was excited to have you come in as our guest. Thank God for Evolution. I just saw the title. I'm like, okay, I get it. Because, you know, I've always believed in that God created basically evolution, and that instead of the world being created in 6 days, it took, you know, 6 billion years.
Actually, 14 billion years.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm reminded of is this old joke, and you probably know this one because you hear it. It's a kid's joke. Is you say, you know, the guy asks God, God, what is, you know, $1 million to you? Oh, $1 million to me is like a penny. Oh, God, what is, you know, 1 million years to you like? Well, 1 million years is like a second. You know, and then you say, the kid says, well, God, can I have a penny? And God goes, yeah, in a second.
You know, I had forgotten that one. I did hear that years ago, but I'd forgotten it.
Because it seems to,
yeah,
when you get into this concept of deep time that you're talking about,
yes,
and that's the argument, the discrepancy between the evolutionary idea of 14 billion years versus the creation idea of 6,000 years. To me, that's the key right there, is if you can open up your mind to realize that when God, on the first day, God created this, that, and the other thing, and the second day, this, the next thing, each of those days was, you know, billions of years long.
Well, and there are hundreds of creation stories around the world.
Right.
And all of them are subjectively meaningful. All of them inspire the people who hold that story, whether they, that story, some traditions imagine God as a great eagle or as a turtle or as a, in fact, yeah. In the program that I do, my main evening program, it's about a 90-minute PowerPoint program.
Okay.
And one of the things I have is a picture of a boulder, a huge boulder in a field, just not, there's no mountains, there's no forest anywhere nearby. It's just this boulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and the question that I ask is, if you lived 500 years ago, how would you describe how that boulder got there? I mean, you or your people, your tribe, your yeah. culture would have had some story. We have to have a story.
Right. The great bird dropped it, or,
exactly.
or the,
and God did it. Probably would have right. been the way that most cultures would yeah. have it. But then in the 1920s, J. Harlan Bretz, a geologist, noticed these interesting geological forms in eastern Washington and western Montana, such as these boulders in the middle of the field, yeah. such as long rolling hills, and such as what's called the channeled scablands, where all the topsoil had been washed away for 30 feet down to the bedrock lava mm. and created these huge caverns. And he proposed that the only way to make sense of these was that giant cataclysmic floods, many of them, dozens of them, had occurred. And nobody took him seriously until the 1960s with the advent of aerial photography from 10,000 feet looking down. It was as obvious as a walk on the beach what these long rolling hills were. There were ripple marks, giant ripple marks. It's
oh
clear.
My gosh.
And now there's not a geologist anywhere in the world that would debate how all these geological forms came into being.
So that rock, that boulder is a pebble that washed
well, exactly.
up in a giant flood.
17 times in the last 2 million years, the ice sheets have come south and the ice sheets have gone back. We call them glaciers.
Yeah.
17 times the glaciers have come and gone. And every time the glaciers came south, they blocked the Clark Fork River, creating this huge a dam, creating a huge valley of water. In fact, they estimate it's called Lake Missoula. They estimate that it was larger than Lake Huron and Lake Erie combined.
That's
and then
lake.
When it was 2,000 feet deep, it broke the ice dam, and in 48 hours, all of this water rushed to the Pacific Ocean. And it carried boulders in icebergs mm-hmm. along the way, and then dropped along the way. And so 500 years ago, people said God did it.
Yeah.
And now geologists say, well, no, God didn't do it. It happened through natural causes. And what you and I now know, and what a lot of people are coming to know, is that these are different ways of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
The words God and evolution are pointing to the same divine creative process. Both answer the question, how did we get here? How did everything get here?
Right.
One uses what I call the day language of science. The other uses the night language of religion. But both are true. In fact, arguing, I thought about this way the other day, arguing whether it was God or evolution that created everything. It's like debating whether it was me or my vocal cords that produced this sentence. Or,
wow.
or arguing whether right. it was Gaia or plate tectonics that created the oceans and the mountains. I mean, such silly and largely right. unnecessary confusion, I think, will remain the norm unless we distinguish.
The fact is that it happened and that, yeah, okay, and that there's, wow.
And it's a divine creative process. It's not like God's just some being up there out there somewhere.
Well, when you talked earlier about the ripple marks and being able to finally now figure that out after years of puzzlement, also brought to mind a part of your book, Thank God for Evolution, thankgodforevolution.com, in which you talked about how we now are, in effect, know stuff that our parents couldn't have known and that our grandparents certainly couldn't have known about the world around us.
Exactly.
Because there's been so much more knowledge in the past couple of generations. That's mind-boggling itself.
Exactly. And well, but we talked before about technology. I believe last week we talked about mm-hmm. technology. And one of the interesting things is, I mean, imagine that you saw somebody's arm fully infected, okay?
Yeah.
500 years ago, how would you think about infection before microscopes? See, it wasn't yeah. difficult to understand infection before microscopes. It was impossible.
Put a bell around their neck and then walk out to the outskirts of town,
yeah,
I think
exactly.
is what you might do.
It was impossible yeah. to have a natural or factual way of understanding, what I call a day language way of understanding
right.
infection before microscopes. It wasn't difficult to understand infection. It was impossible.
Yeah.
In the same way, trying to understand the structure of the universe without telescopes, it's not difficult. It's impossible.
Yes.
And the point that I'm making is that without a sacred or an inspiring understanding of the history of the universe, and when I say evolution, that's what I'm meaning, is the history of cosmos, earth, life, and humanity as one meaningful story, one sacred story. Without an understanding of the major breakthroughs in evolution, it's impossible to understand ourselves, our world, or what's needed for humanity to survive and thrive in the coming decades. That's why I say mm-hmm. nothing, at this time in history, nothing matters more than what we think about evolution.
Well, let's talk about the future. We've talked about the past and evolution and how we got here, but how is it going to help us in the future, Michael Dowd?
Well, personally, it helps us recognize that our religious insights are larger, more meaningful, and have more this world reality than ever before. For example, the whole notion of original sin, the whole notion of the fall of Adam and Eve. We now through evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science, we have a deeper way of appreciating these in a way that also that can make a difference in our lives so that it becomes much, much easier to live lives of what I call Christ-like integrity, mm-hmm. that is deepest integrity. But the other, in terms of our species, what is it? What guidance do we get from the history of the universe when we interpret it through sacred eyes? Well, one of the things we get is that God has been speaking, reality has been revealing through 14 billion years, and every scientific fact discovered is simultaneously a discovery by science and also a revelation of God. And so we understand, how did the universe go from simple atoms to more complex atoms to molecules to more complex molecules to creatures to more mm-hmm. complex creatures to societies and more complex societies? How did that happen? One of the key things that we learn is that there must be, at every level, there must be an alignment of the self-interest, the natural self-interest of the parts, with the well-being of the whole. So that when we recognize that, and that's how prokaryotic bacteria created eukaryotic cells, that's how eukaryotic cells created multicellularity, that's how we went from cooperating among families and clans to cooperating at the scale of tribes to the cooperating mm-hmm. at the scale, at every level. So when we recognize that, God's giving us guidance. We're getting guidance from the scriptures of the universe itself.
He's saying be more complex, be more self-aware, all these things.
And to be more compassionate, to be more loving, to be more integrous.
Because you have to do that in order to get along with the other people in your village slash city slash corporation.
Exactly. And world. I mean, I remember hearing a few months ago, actually probably it was close to a year ago now, there's a guy with a real radio voice, and he said—
No, that wasn't me.
He said, from our good friends who brought you Pearl Harbor, Mitsubishi Motors.
No.
You know, we cooperate with people today that our grandparents hated or feared.
Yeah.
And so when we recognize this is moving into the into the future, we can get some clear guidance from God.
So that's
reality.
Where we get to the whole love one another
as I have loved you.
Yeah. That's where, okay.
Jesus was
constantly— in order to be able to survive in the future.
Exactly.
That's the plan.
Jesus was constantly saying, I mean, the two types of religious people that Jesus was most critical of were the Pharisees and the Sadducees, those who believed that being right with God was being in the right lineage, mm-hmm. and those who believed that being right with God meant having the right beliefs or practices. And what Jesus kept saying is, no, it's larger than that. He kept breaking open. I mean, he hung out with the sinners, the outcasts, the prostitutes.
Right, the Samaritans.
The Samaritans, right, the tax collectors and whatever, people that were despised. He was saying, no, your circles of compassion are too small. Break them open. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're now needing to do now. Our circles
of compassion. These Pharisees couldn't even grasp a concept of anything beyond the edges of the flat earth in their mind.
Right.
The idea that there was a whole world out there.
And they also couldn't grasp the concept that God was involved in anywhere other than their tradition. And so when we now recognize that God has been involved at the entire universe for billions of years, mm-hmm. we can get clear guidance for how to move forward in a healthy way, which is it's embodying all the values that Jesus taught.
How do you justify the crusades of the past where it was, well, we're either going to convert you to our religion or kill you? Or the terrorists of today who basically are saying, we're either going to convert you to our religion or kill you.
I remember seeing a cartoon.
That's kind of what it is. It's the same.
I remember seeing a cartoon once where there was this Muslim who was down on the ground with a Christian on a horseback with a spear or sword, right at the throat of the mm-hmm. Muslim. And the Muslim saying, tell me about this Jesus. I'm really interested.
But now it's the other way around.
Right.
It's, the suicide bomber is...
And that's why this universe story, Connie and I, we have two websites, actually. One of them is thankgodforevolution.com, and that's where people can download the first 50 pages of my book for free and that sort of thing. But also, we have a website that we've had in existence for about 7 years, and it generates about 250,000 to 500,000 hits a month. It's an educational website, and it's called thegreatstory.org, www.thegreatstory.org. And the reason we call the universe story the great story is it's the story that includes all stories. There's no religious story. There's no cultural story. There's no human story that's not part of the 14 billion year epic of evolution.
Mm-hmm. So part of that great story is the Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism Buddhism and Islam.
How all the religious traditions came into being and how they've been evolving for thousands of years.
Okay, so we need to move past in our mind this idea of my God's better than your God.
Well, certainly, in a world where weapons of mass destruction are getting smaller and smaller, smarter and smarter, and ever more easy to obtain, if we don't find ways of cooperating across ethnic and religious differences in the next 50, 60 years, we're in serious trouble as a species. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking of in terms of why our worldview matters, why evolution matters, is that it's not a surprise that America is not leading the world in terms of response to global warming, climate change, because 1 in 3 Americans believe these are the end times anyway, so why bother?
Now, you see, but you mentioned earlier when you talked about the pebble or the giant boulder in the middle of the field, that it struck me as thinking, well, you know what? That was global warming followed by global cooling, followed by global warming, followed by global cooling.
Exactly.
So right now, yeah, or sure that global warming exists, but we had, was it only 30 years ago, the cover of Time magazine said, well, the next ice age is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're in a world where the climate is going to change over
exactly.
time.
Exactly. So the question isn't, is this the only time that global warming has happened, or are we humans solely responsible? Not at all.
But we have, but we can be partially responsible.
And exactly. And to the, well, we are partially responsible, certainly. The question becomes, can we adapt in a way that is humane? I mean, we've got millions of people that are living along shorelines that if the ocean rise, sure, the oceans have risen and fallen many,
right.
many times. But if the oceans rise, you know, 5 or 10 feet, you've got millions of people without a home. So the question becomes, again, how can we live our lives and create structures, governmental structures, economic structures, legal structures that align the self-interest of individuals, corporations, and nations with the well-being of the planet so that we can alleviate as much suffering as possible and we can move into the future in a God-honoring way, in a sacred, in an inspiring way.
We're talking to the next president of the United States, Michael Dowd, who has written his book. I'm kidding. Has written Thank God for Evolution. Okay. We've talked in the book and we've talked on the show, both last week and this, about how people have gotten collectively, how humans and how the world has gotten collectively smarter over time because we retain information, we transfer information, we are able to teach and write and store and all those things. How do we get that message across then to the people who are in the path of the tsunami, the hurricane, the global warming, the whatever? How do we get everybody on the same page?
Well, I think, yeah, great question. I think that the key is education, but people aren't going to be open to learning something unless they feel it in some way enriches their life. And in fact, they're going to be resisting information if they think that it threatens what they hold most sacred, mm-hmm. what they most hold of most value.
Okay. So we saw that at Hurricane Katrina where people wouldn't budge because they didn't want to give up their home, even though they were in danger to stay in their home. And for many of them, it cost them their lives.
Right.
They wouldn't budge because they held that so dear
right.
to them, correct?
And so that's one of the, exactly. And so that's one of the reasons why what I've given my life to, what Connie, my wife and I, and she's a science writer and
where is she, by the way? Is she in the van? Is
no,
she parked outside?
No. She's staying at a home that somebody gave us to stay at
okay.
up in the mountains.
Just occurred to me that you guys don't have a place to live. And you're
oh,
driving
oh no. We always are staying with people in their homes. What we do is we take over somebody's guest bedroom and we make that our office.
Okay.
So we set up our card tables and our laptops and so that's our office. But we almost always sleep in Angel is our van. It's a high-top Mercedes van. It's a Dodge Sprinter.
Okay.
And so it's our bedroom on wheels.
Well, I didn't mean to get you off on that tangent.
We can
get back to that. We'll get back to your ministry again. I'll make a note to get back to that. But I do want to talk about that we're talking about the Katrina victims, the people who didn't want to change their...
Right. Well, part of it, again, as I was saying before, I think that evolution, that is the history of the universe that we know through science, is threatening to people. If people have this belief, it's an erroneous belief. I mean, many atheists and many fundamentalists are colluding on this belief. They both think that if you really understood science, if you really understood evolution, you'd be left with a depressing, meaningless worldview.
Mm.
And that's just not true. Is it possible to focus on certain processes within the system that don't inspire? Well, of course.
Yeah.
But you'd have to ignore these long-term trends. And when you look at these long-term trends, it's so easy to be inspired religiously. And so, for example, the first time that I got a chance to speak to an entire group of young earth creationists, well, that was an interesting experience.
And young earth meaning the
people
who believe
the earth is 6,000 years old.
Okay,
right?
Period.
And that every word in the Bible is literally true. None of it's, you know,
Methuselah lived for
exactly
500 plus years.
And that snake really did talk and
okay.
et cetera. Okay. So all of it interpreted literally. So I spoke
New
to
Testament also? Or both?
Oh, yeah. Everything.
Okay.
Yeah. So I spoke to a group of about, I don't know, 40, 45 students. It was an InterVarsity Christian Fellowship group up in Canada. And I, at the beginning, I asked, I said, how many of you do not accept an evolutionary worldview? Almost everybody raised their hands.
Okay.
I rephrased the question. Same thing. I thought, this is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
And I just stood there and I just was silent. And I just, whether you call it trusting God, faith in God, trusting my unconscious, whatever you want, I just trusted. I didn't know what I was going to say. And this is what came out. And this is what I just opened my mouth and I started speaking. And I said, those of you who reject evolution, you're absolutely right to have rejected evolution. And I was silent. I said, because the only version of evolution that most of us have ever been exposed to is a chance, meaningless, purposeless, cruel, godless, directionless process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not at all what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I was silent. I said, now, if you'll allow me to, Not because I'm trying to convert you or convince you. It's okay with me if you differ. But if you're open to it, I would love to share with you why I am passionately excited about a God-glorifying, Christ-edifying, Scripture-honoring way of thinking about evolution. And I was silent for 10 seconds. And I could literally feel the whole room open up. They were going to let me speak. And I had some of the same young, angry, testosterone-filled young guys, 18 to 20-year-old guys.
So not only the young earth people, they're young people.
They're young, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Who came loaded for bear. One guy had his King James Bible in a Strong's Concordance laid out on the desk. He was going to blow my butt away. And to his credit, he came up to me after my two-hour program and gave me a bear hug and said, "Now, you haven't converted me, but I'm not threatened by your perspective." And, some of it was really exciting, which was a huge move in 2 hours. And so I think until religious people, devout religious people, are exposed to a way of thinking about the history of the universe in a way that inspires them religiously, I think they should continue to reject evolution.
All right. Now, let me take the other side of the coin. We're talking with Michael Dowd, author of Thank God for Evolution, the website, thankgodforevolution.com. I have a friend who's an atheist. I have actually more than one friend who are atheists.
Yeah.
They look at it from the other way. They look at science as a way of disproving the existence of God and disproving everything that you and I hold dear. You know, to them, it's all, well, you know, we can see here, obviously, this stuff all just, you know, evolved and stuff came together and God wasn't needed to make any of these things that we have. I disagree with it, but maybe you can help me out with the apologetics on it.
I speak to atheists all the time. I mean, I speak to atheists as often as I do. Well, that'd be an exaggeration, but I speak to a lot of non-religious.
Because where do they meet?
Actually, there's a lot of atheists that meet at Unitarian Universalist churches.
Okay.
Because it's the only place they can fellowship. I mean, there's a lot of people that are very religious people that are also Unitarian Universalist churches, but my point is that
I went to an atheist church, but there was nobody there.
Yeah, right. In fact, let me tell you a story. The day my book came out, my book was first published by a very small independent publisher that could only print 3,000 copies at a print run.
Yeah.
So it was, even though I had 5 Nobel Prize winning scientists and all these theologians and ministers that had written endorsements, if you went into 95% of the bookstores in America, you didn't find my book anywhere.
Right.
And so then,
thank God for Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, a large publisher, Viking, bought the book.
Which is how I heard about you.
Yeah. And now it came out in last June. It came out in the Viking edition. The first day that the book came out, June 23rd, I think it was, I was interviewed 15 times on television and 4 times on radio within a 4-hour period. Basically, I sat in a studio and they beamed me to stations all around the country.
Familiar with that.
And a dozen of the questions, the first question was this: "Now, how can you as a Christian minister be married to an atheist?"
Where'd they get that idea?
Well, because Connie's a longtime science writer. She, for many years, she called herself an atheist.
Okay.
You know, she uses the term religious naturalist. But, you know, she doesn't hesitate. She would still say she's an atheist. If what you mean by a theist is a big daddy in the sky somewhere who blesses someone's
life. Sorry, when you say what you mean by theist.
Exactly. If what you mean by theist is somebody who believes in a big daddy out there somewhere who blesses some and smites others,
right,
then Connie's an atheist. She doesn't believe in that kind of a God.
Okay.
But she celebrates the kind of God that I talk about in my book.
Right.
But anyway, here's the thing. So I gave my sort of standard response, which is that.
Mm.
And I went home that afternoon and I told Connie that, you know, like a dozen people asked, that was the first question. And she giggled and she said, "Well, the next time you're asked that, just tell them, what can I say? She's just really great in bed." She said, that ought to stop them in their tracks. But, you know, the amazing thing, we did a Unitarian, it was a United Church of Christ, because I've spoken in hundreds of Christian churches.
Right.
And we spoke at a United Church of Christ church just outside of Columbus, Ohio. And the minister asked us to help select the hymns. So Connie and I went to the church and we were helping him select the hymns. And Connie said, "Oh, let's do Holy, Holy, Holy. I've always loved that one." So here we are in the middle of the church service. My non-theistic wife is belting out, "God in three persons, blessed Trinity." At which point the minister whispers over to me, says, "Your wife's atheism is very suspect."
Well, we're talking about Connie, the wife of Michael Dowd, and her name is Connie Barlow.
Yeah.
Connie Barlow, the science writer.
Right.
And she helped you write
this
book?
She really did. She,
you're listed as the author.
Three of the chapters in the book were, she wrote the first draft of the chapters. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to be listed as a co-author because she felt that it really has to be a singular voice, and she wanted it to be my voice.
Okay.
But she's also been a ghostwriter. She helped one of the world's leading scientists write a book, and her name isn't even on it. So she's done ghostwriting in the past. She was an editor for Columbia University Press. She's written 4 acclaimed science books, MIT Press, Copernicus Books, Basic Books. So she's internationally known
so
as a science writer.
So she is that skeptic, that
exactly,
that science person,
right,
who now can look and see, because I think there's 2 ways of looking at science, and I think you're taking obviously the way that I'm going to agree with, is that science can just as easily prove the existence of God, unlike my atheist friend wants to think that it will disprove.
But here's the thing. Let me stretch you on one point that I think is really important. Any God that can be believed in or not believed in is a trivial God. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an undeniably real God, a God that even an atheist can't deny. Remember the nesting dolls?
Yes.
Okay. God from this perspective.
We talked about those at the end of last week's show.
Russian nesting dolls, right? Yeah. Subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells. God is a sacred proper name for that one and only creative reality, that ultimate reality that includes all other creativity, yet also transcends all other creativity. And this is a God beyond belief or disbelief. And I mean, it would make no sense for me to say, Frank, do you believe in water?
I have some right here. Yeah, but yes, I mean, I believe
you
know,
it
in
doesn't
water.
Matter whether you believe in water or not. We're 50 to 70% water.
Water exists.
We wouldn't exist
period.
Without water.
Right.
You know, do you believe in life? Do you believe in reality? Those are nonsense questions. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you believe in life or not. We're an expression of life. But now what you say about life is believable or not. Somebody can say life is so kind and wonderful. And somebody else can say life sucks. It's terrible. Well, that's believable or not, depending upon your experience. But the fact of life just is.
Well, it's both. It's both good and bad.
I mean, it doesn't matter whether you believe in reality or not. Reality is something that every plant, every animal, and every human being cannot not experience. And so one of my favorite quotes from Philip K. Dick, he says, reality is that which when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. And that's what I mean. I'm pointing to ultimate reality. And that's where Connie and I, we actually had to coin our own term. Because sometimes conservatives will ask me, say, well, what are you anyway? Are you a theist? Are you an atheist? Are you a pantheist? I can't tell what you are. Mm. I had to coin my own term. I say, I'm a creatheist. And Connie, my wife, she's a creatheist. Now, we spell it the same way. We mean the same thing by it. Mm-hmm. We just pronounce it differently. I'm a creatheist, and she's a creatheist.
Kria, as in creation. Theist, as in God-believing.
Exactly.
God-believing creation.
Well, not God-believing. God-knowing.
God-knowing.
See, I don't really believe in God. I know God intimately. And your atheist friend may not choose to call.
We can call him Todd if you'd like.
Okay. Well, Todd may not call ultimate reality God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Stoic Greeks, you know what the Stoics referred to as ultimate reality?
What?
Cosmos, a proper name, an I-thou relationship. Not the cosmos, little c, like the pulpit or the stool or, you know, the computer. No, then it's an object. No, cosmos, a living being. See, we're a subset of the whole. There's no one right way to talk about ultimate reality. And so that's why this term creatheism or creatheism is a bridge-building concept. Here's the thing. Theism as a concept, atheism as a concept, pantheism as a concept, all these concepts emerged long before we had an evolutionary understanding of reality.
Right, because the ancient Greeks had many gods in their mythology.
Exactly, and polytheism, all these. Now that we have an evolutionary understanding, we can recognize that these all are inadequate. We need terms that reflect a deep, science-based evolutionary worldview that's also religiously inspiring. And that's what my book, Thank God for Evolution, is really attempting to do, is show people how science and religion are mutually enriching.
Because there's a reason why, as we became aware of our surroundings, we became more than the little cells that we started as in the stardust that we started as a gazillion years ago, or 14 billion years ago. Okay. There's a reason why we have this quest, this reflection, this idea where so many people simultaneously come up with the idea of a higher power.
Exactly. And we
That's
can
not
give
a coincidence.
Exactly. And we can honor the whole. We can give glory, to use religious language, we can give glory to God. That is, we can honor the whole of reality. And it really is humans beginning to become an immune system within the body of life. We've been acting somewhat cancerously because, like the cancer cell, we thought we were separate from Earth. Mm. We thought our true home was only elsewhere after we died. We didn't know that we were the Earth becoming conscious of itself. We were the universe becoming aware of itself. So now we recognize this, taking this sacred understanding, this God-honoring understanding, human beings are, I think, destined to be an immune system within the body of life. And that's tremendously hopeful.
And because the great story continues and is all-encompassing, that when they find water on Mars or some bacteria on Jupiter or whatever it is they're going to find, that fits into the story.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, Connie, my wife, wrote a book with one of the world's leading scientists on this topic. Connie, my wife, believes that in 10 places in this solar system, we'll find bacteria. She can tell you which moons of which planets we're likely to find them.
Now, for sentient life like us, is it going to be another universe out there or another galaxy out there? How big are we talking?
Yeah, there's a thing called astrobiology within the NASA. A lot of people at NASA are into astrobiology right now. And it's this notion that bacterial life is probably rampant throughout the universe. But the conditions may be very rare where the planet can't be too close or too far from its star. It can't be too large or too small. It's this Goldilocks effect.
Right.
And I think that's where it may be rare to have consciousness that has evolved to where it knows that it knows.
Our porridge is just right.
Yeah, exactly.
That sums it up. We've been talking with Michael Dowd. Thank God for Evolution is the book, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. Both the website, thankgodforevolution.com, and your older site, you said,
is thegreatstory.org.
Which I guess we need
which
to
look at.
Which
is an educational website.
Okay.
It's just all, people can also access that one from the thankgodrevolution.com website.
So if you've got a spare bedroom and you want.
But people can also, as I mentioned before, people can download a free copy of the first 50 pages of my book, pray about it and see if this is what you're drawn to.
Well, I hope you'll come back to Knoxville again soon.
Great.
And consider this part of your North American home.
I'm sure we will.
This is the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.